1 minute.
We had 1 minute, 2 minutes ago.
Oh, we did?
10, 9, 8.
We had 1 minute, 2 minutes ago?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Page 53, in the middle. When we became alcoholics, crushed by a self-imposed crisis we could not postpone or evade, we had to fearlessly face the proposition that either God is everything or else he is nothing. God either is or he isn't. What was our choice to be? That's one of the strangest paragraphs I ever read the first time. The first couple of times I read the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous. We had to fearlessly face the proposition that God either is everything or else he is nothing. I don't understand why. Why does God have to be everything or nothing? He is or he isn't. And then it says, what was our choice to be? Like I could choose whether or not there is a power of this universe. You know, God either is or he isn't. He's either everything or he is nothing. Why is that? It's not rhetorical. Somebody can help me if you want to. I'm kind of an interactive guy, so if you want to say something, then help me. I'm still open to learning something. God either is, he's either everything or he's nothing. Why is that? Yes. Oh, you can. I can believe no way. Don't tell me what I can or can't do now. I cannot believe. I came in not believing. Can't believe halfway.
I think it's interesting how that is a pretty big, that's an absolute. Either you believe or you do not believe.
Either you believe or you do not.
It says that all I need is a little tiny bit of willingness. So what's that all about?
What is that all about? Seems to be a contradiction. It says an absolute, either you believe or you don't believe, but then it says, all I need is a little bit of willingness. What is that all about? That's to get started. But God is everything or he is nothing. Let's consider that going backwards. Let's work backwards from that one. He's either everything or he's nothing. What if he's not everything? Who's not everything? What if he can help me pay my bills? What if he can take the bottle out of my mouth? And what if he can do that, but he can't do the relationships? He can't help me with my emotional. What? What if he can only do some things? Then he's not infinite. Who can do some things for me? My sponsor. People. If he's less than everything, he's a person. Definition of God. The definition of God. Every limitless. No, if he's less than everything, he's a person. Who's less than everything? Me. Me. I can make you smile sometime. I can pay a bill for you, but I can't make you self-sufficient. You know, I can't give you the power to go out and do work. I can't breathe the breath of life in you. I can't give you the power to make it through this world. I can't do a lot of stuff. There's lots of stuff that I'm limited in. God is either everything or he's nothing. Definition of God. No limits. By definition. And I said, oh, okay. So if I think, and that's why it says, what was my choice to be? Because if my choice is he ain't everything, I ain't got him. I don't have him. And it ain't so much that God is not there. It's if I don't choose to access him. God loved me so much, he won't impose his will on mine. Allow me to do whatever it is I want to do. Gives me free will. God is either everything or he is nothing. What was my choice to be? That was such an interesting concept for me. And so when I look at that, he either is or he isn't. You know. And you did get at it and just know half pregnant. Pregnant or you not? Yeah. You know. He is or he's not. Definition of God. No half measure, no half power. No piece of power. He's a piece of power, he's a person. I have a lot of things that I work. So I got to that and I was like, wow, that's an interesting concept. You know, either is or he isn't, you know. First thing my sponsor ever said to me, two things you need to know about God. Somebody brought it up. You know, he is and he ain't you. You know, and this chapter expounds on that quite a bit. Where do I find this power and how do I access this power? Because we've been, Bob does a lot of talking and it's about looking everywhere, trying S, chanting, Buddhist, Namyo Renge Kyo, you know, various religions, sampling and going and the rest. And it says, actually, we were fooling ourselves on page 55 in the middle. For deep down in every man, woman, and child is the fundamental idea of God. Deep down in every man, woman, is the fundamental idea, not a well-formed idea, not a well-formed concept, which is what we're talking about today. It's the fundamental idea that there is something else that I'm connected to that's other than myself. It's bigger than myself, fundamentally. It's the kind of cry that comes when you think, when you don't even think about God. You don't even, God ain't a working part of your consciousness. God is not a working part of your life. And when I'm sitting up in the jailhouse or when the lights are flashing on me or something involuntarily, it's that kind of God help me. It's that kind of involuntary, I don't even know myself that I have this idea. Sometimes driving along and I'm just pressed with the world on me, whether I'm sober or before I got sober. Just this idea. God, man. Do something, you know, just this idea of something outside of me, just this idea of being at the beach and feeling something that's not for a person, something, seeing the ocean and feeling something, seeing a sunset and being awed and feeling, it's not definable because I don't say the G word yet and I'm not really into that, but it's something that I'm awed about. And sometimes I do say it. Sometimes I do believe it. I've grown up with that belief, not a well-formed conception. Deep down in every man, woman, and child is the fundamental idea of God. It may be obscured by calamity, by pomp, by worship of other things, but in some form or other it is there. And that's what it is that we do. That's what it is that we do. Almost everybody, because 12 steps, that's not what's going to have me sober. Almost every single one of us come to the process. I bring myself to the process of recovery already sober. Nobody starts taking the steps still drunk. What you trying to say, Ralph? So what has it that's got me sober enough to get me to these steps that get me in touch with this power? These 12 steps, spiritual in nature, that can expel the obsession. What is God's grace? God's grace. And this idea of God is covered up. Sometimes I do a visual, and I kind of think about inside of me. Depends on you. Calamity, pomp, worship of other things. All the negative things that have happened in my life. I look at things, when I say calamity, they don't even have to be calamities that happened to me. I look at calamities in the world and I say it can be no God. Babies born the way they're born, wars, and you look at TV, and just the things in my own family. I had a niece that died when she was 2 years old. I had, you know, my son is like this. I had two nephews shot in drive-by shooting, you know, and a calamity, pomp. Kind of guy I am. You know, I'm interested in big things and I'm interested in having things and I'm interested in impressing. So I go out and I seek others and so that's the kind of way I live. I live big. You know, and my God is stuff and acquiring stuff. You know, so it's covered up by that. Who I puffed up and who I think I am. Worship of other things, money, property, prestige, women, you know. My idea, so worship others. So you start piling on, piling on, piling on, piling on. You think about a big earthquake somewhere and you see all the rubble inside of me. Just imagine that kind of rubble just inside of me. And I get tore up enough, you know, and I get crushed by this self-imposed crisis, you know. And somehow, some way, this is what grace is. Grace is powerful enough to pierce the rubble. And it's just somehow I imagine it being a sliver. Imagine it being a sliver, and it's that power of the power, you know, to make a blade of grass crack the concrete, you know, that power that tells birds to go south in this winter and tell bears to go hibernate. And we know they don't wear watches and have calendars. How they know? How they know to do it? What does that? You know, what on a regular basis makes the sun come up at the same time every day and go down at the same time? What's regulating? What's stopping the ocean from coming all the way up on the land. It stops right where it stops, and it goes back. What? You know, and I kind of envision this grace that's so powerful that it pierces the rubble. It pierces the rubble, and it's a sliver, and it's a thin window. And it's a thin window for alcoholics like us to let the grace in and not shut it out. And that window is, you know, when the window of desperation and opportunity meet, and I jump through it. Because if I don't jump through in that little time, like when I went to get my son, desperation meets opportunity. He desperate, I'm there. But he didn't stay desperate long enough, and he wasn't desperate enough, and he didn't jump through the window. I remember when I jumped through the window, October 11th, because if I'd have waited till October the 12th, what happens with a guy like me is things change in my mind, and I start thinking to myself, yeah, when he had that pistol in your mouth, he wasn't really going to pull the trigger. He was just playing. You know, I replayed a scene and I painted different. It wasn't really that bad. You're making a little bit too much of this. You know what I'm saying? And so but I jumped through the window. Grace. And that sliver, I can live on for a time. I can live on for a time. And everybody's time is different. Everybody's time is different. So what we embark on is removing the rubble, clearing away the rubble so that I can hear the voice. Because the voice is real. At first, you can barely hear it. Barely hear it. Can't hear it at all sometimes. You know, so I embark on this process that we'll be talking about for for these next hours. And it's clearing away that rubble. Clearing away what's blocking me from the sunlight. All the sunlight. Not just a sliver. From blocking me from the sunlight of God's grace. Grace sufficient to meet the need. Grace sufficient to recover from alcoholism. And so I embark on the journey of stepping in the sunlight. God is there and grace is shining. I'm just blocked. I'm blocked. Grace is grace. It don't stop. You know, I want a clear channel. You know, the receiver is what's blocked. The sender is sending all the time. The sender is sending all the time. That's what God does. Don't have no choice. God's love, that's it, that's all. Sender sending. Grace is always coming. People be talking about we the chosen ones, and I think to myself, you know, I'm a father. I don't have chosen kids. All my kids are my kids. They choose whether to follow what it is daddy's doing. They choose. We're the ones who chose. We're the ones who chose to clear the rubble. We're the ones who chose to answer the call. We're the ones who chose to be desperate enough and stay desperate enough long enough to do what it takes to stand in the sunlight.
Thanks, Rob. I'm Bob, an alcoholic. That part that Ralph talked about so well on page 53, that this proposition that God is either everything or else he's nothing. And it kind of implies that even to entertain that proposition, we have to be crushed. Our ego has to be smashed. Dr. Harry Tebow talked about recovery from alcoholism takes ego reduction and depth. That's why we all have to hit some sort of bottom. We have to get to a point of hopelessness within ourselves. And just to entertain a proposition that God is either everything or he's nothing. A proposition that is actually Buddhist in nature. Buddhism is often referred to as a religion, but it's not really a religion. It's an approach. It's an attitude. That when the first Jesuit minister, first missionaries went to the Orient and they encountered Buddhism, they came back to America and Europe excited about it. And the church didn't know what to make of it. They thought, well, that's some kind of heathen religion. And the Jesuits uniformly, every single one of them said, no, it's not. This will make us better Catholics. And there's a story that is sort of the foundation of the approach of Hinduism that has come into Buddhism. And it's a story of creation. And it's very different than Judeo-Christian story of creation that we all know about Adam and Eve in the garden, etc. The Hindu story is called Maya. And it's a story that God existed unto himself. And he devised a cosmic game. And the game was he would break himself up into an infinite number of parts, give all the parts a disguise, a skin suit, and give all the parts amnesia, and let them loose. And the game is which parts are going to see through the hallucination of separation first. The Hindus and the Buddhists call that enlightenment, when you realize that God really is everything, because it's everything is everything. There is no separation. It's an illusion of the ego. It's the great, that Maya means the great illusion, the great hallucination. Is that there's, or Einstein said it when he said that he believed the great illusion of mankind was that there was more than one of us here. See, God is really everything. Or he is nothing. And when he's nothing, we live in a state of desolation and disconnectedness and loneliness. That Carl Jung was right when he said that our thirst for alcohol was really a thirst for unity, a thirst to return to that from which I came, a thirst to reconnect, a thirst of a homecoming, a thirst to be once again part of the everything rather than separate and alone and part of the nothing. That the nothing is the hallucination. That I am you. And those of us that are sober a long time in Alcoholics Anonymous, almost, if you're active in AA and you're active in the steps and you're sponsoring people, you can almost can't avoid the experience of realizing the oneness. You listen to enough fifth steps. It's the same person. Over and over and over. It's the same person. I haven't heard anything new in a fifth step in 29, 30 years. I'm always hopeful. I'd like to hear something new and exciting. And Jeff wants to do a little step work this weekend. I'm hoping he'll come up with something, you know, creative, you know, vibrating lawn rake, chunky peanut butter, Visqueen, oil, something interesting. But it's never like that. It's never anything great. It's always the same lost, desolate, nothing, inadequate, scared person frantically trying to connect to something to fill their own vacancies and stepping on the toes of everyone around them in the process. It's always the same story. Never changes. It never changes. We live as God is. We live as if God was nothing and we were everything. Mm-hmm. When really it's the other way around. We are nothing. God is everything. And in that is the unity and the oneness. Because I'm part of everything also. I was in the mall in Las Vegas 15 years or so ago with a bunch of people in AA, and we were kind of walking around looking at stuff. And in the middle of between the stores in the hall, in the aisles in the mall, they're big, very wide aisles, and there's kiosks in the center where they sell telephone, cell phone covers and calendars and cosmetic products and hats. Just crazy, they set these little kiosks up. Well, we're coming through the mall, and one of the people that's with me gets all excited. There's this kiosk with these pictures framed, most of them, of what to me look like blobs of color. They're nothing, like Rorschach paintings or something. Very weird, and they're holograms, right? And I'm looking at these pictures, and these people are excited about it. And the guy that works there is excited. He says, can you see the castle? I don't see nothing, man. I just see a bunch of weird color, just blurry stuff. He says, you don't see the castle. He says, it's really there. It's three-dimensional. It pops out of the picture. I'm thinking, they're pulling my leg, right? But they're excited about it. They're real. And I'm trusting that there's something there, but I can't see it. They said, what about this one? See the big dragon coming out of the picture?
Oh, man, I don't see nothing. He says, keep looking. Well, because I trust these guys, and I believe that they're sincere, that they're seeing something, I keep looking. And I'm looking and looking. And the guy's telling me, he says, just relax. Look, get closer to it. Look and just relax. Pretend, don't try to see it. Because I'm like, think I'm going to see it by will. All I'm doing is getting a headache. I can't. Just relax. Yeah. And all of a sudden, pop. Wow. It popped. It was three-dimensional, right out of the freaking thing, man. It just, boom, a castle. Now that I saw the castle, I look over here and looking at this other one. And just in a couple seconds, bam, a dragon. There's another one with planets in the universe and a spaceship. And sometimes God's like that. You do all this work in Alcoholics Anonymous, and all of a sudden something's there. All of a sudden something shows up. I heard a story years ago about this little kid who lived on a farm, and they were with his dad, and they were very self-sufficient. And one day he's out along the highway, the front of the ranch, mending some fence. And there's a telephone pole there. And on the telephone pole, there's this bright neon yellow poster. And it says, circus coming to town. It gives the date. And on the poster is pictures of elephants and tigers and lions and bears. Oh, my. And there's all, it's just amazing looking. There's women standing on horses, riding in the picture. It's an amazing deal. He gets excited. He doesn't know what a circus is, but it looks like something he'd like to see. And he goes back to his dad, and he says, Dad, he says, Papa, there's a circus coming to town. Can I go? And he says, how much is it? He says, the sign says it's a dollar. And his dad says, here's a dollar. You do your chores. I'll let you go to the circus that day. Well, the day of the circus comes, he's up early, before the sun's up, excited to go to the circus. He heads into town. He gets into town, and there's a big crowd of people on Main Street. And he doesn't know what's going on. He pushes up through his little kids. So he pushes up through the crowd, gets up on the curb. And coming down the street is the beginning of a parade, and it's the most amazing thing he ever saw. There's elephants leading the parade with clowns sitting on their backs. There's wagons with giraffes' heads sticking out of them, with giraffes in the wagons. There's wagons with bars on the sides of them with lions and tigers. And it's the most amazing. There's more clowns. There's horses with these girls with all these fancy sequenced and feathered outfits standing bareback on the top of the horses. The very end of the parade, there's this one little clown. He's the last dancing down behind everything else. And the little kid's got the dollar, silver dollar. He holds it up to the clown because he doesn't know what to do with the silver dollar. He's supposed to pay a dollar. So the clown tips his hat. He throws the silver dollar. The clown catches it, bows, walks on down. The parade goes down the street, and the kid goes home. He goes home excited to tell his dad he's seen the circus. Problem is, he never saw the circus. All he saw was the passing parade. I sat in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous for 7 years, and I never saw the circus, but I was part of the passing parade. I didn't know there was more here. I didn't know that there was a power here that could be accessed that would change my life. I thought this was some kind of self-help group that was going to help me to not think about drinking or something. Seemed that way to me. I didn't know that there was a big top. And what we're going to try to do today is tell you how to get in the big top, where the power is, how to access the juice. I was with a guy last weekend who told a story, a good friend of mine, Sandy, and Sandy told a story that I'd heard him tell probably 10 years ago, and I hadn't heard him tell it in a long time. And it's so effective. I'm gonna share it with you. And he's talking about when he was new in AA, and is, you know, he's new like we're all new. He'd burn his life to the ground. He's in danger of losing his wife and kids. He's He's buried in debt. He never thinks he's going to get out of debt. He's about ready to be thrown out of the Marine Corps, which was his career, which means he doesn't even have any job skills outside of flying jet planes, which they don't have things like that at the mall. So he doesn't know where he's going to work. I mean, his life's a mess, and he's full of fear and anxiety. And his sponsor notices that he's not doing very well, sober. And his sponsor says to him, "Whoa, Sandy, we got to get you into the steps." He goes, "Oh, okay, all right." He says, "I need to ask you some questions to see where we are with this spiritual program." He goes, "Okay." He says, "I want to know, have you spent a lot of time in your life in prayer? Do you pray a lot?" Sandy goes, "Pray? Whoa. Well, I don't pray. He says, "Okay, no prayer. All right." He says, "Do you do a lot of meditation?" "No, I don't think I've never meditated. I don't even know what it is." "Okay, no meditation. Do you read a lot of spiritual books?" "Spiritual books? You don't count Hustler, do you?" "No, I don't think so. No, no spiritual books." "Okay, no spiritual books. All right. Do you go to church or some place where you go to get more spiritually enhanced?" "No, I don't do that." "Do you engage in a lot of spiritual conversations throughout your life with people?" "No, I don't." He says, "Okay." I says, "I only got one more question for you. How's all that working?" And he goes, "It was horrible." And maybe that's the pragmatic question. No matter what you've been doing or what you believe in, if you're new, how's that been working for you? We came to believe in the hopelessness and futility of our life as we've been living it. And yet some of us have come here with a lot of prejudices. I was at a treatment center up in Waterville, Maine. I was up there on a... People in AA explained it to me. It was a geographic. I thought I would cross state lines to avoid prosecution. I don't know. I was up there on the run. I had people looking for me, and I end up in this treatment center. And one day in the treatment center, everybody gets excited. We're going to have a special AA meeting. And this van with bars on the windows pulled up, and there's a trustees group from Thomaston State Penitentiary. They're bringing these inmates in to put on an AA meeting. One of them was a 10-minute speaker, one of them was a main speaker. Well, this is not my first rodeo. I'd been around in treatment centers. I'd been exposed to AA for a couple of years by this time. And didn't really care much for AA. And I go to this special speaker meeting, and the guy that's the main speaker is an inmate who's doing life in prison. He'd killed a cop. And he was an outlaw motorcycle guy. Big guy. Guy that must have lifted a lot of weights. Tattoos. Back in those days, tattoos weren't fashionable. You were an outlaw if you had tattoos back in those days. And this guy started telling his story. Big, tough guy, man. Big arms on him. Like, tough guy. Long hair and a beard. I'm listening to him. I'd never seen anybody in AA like this guy. And he's talking about carrying a shotgun and pistol whipping people and running with this gang and shooting this cop and all this stuff, man. And he's a tough guy. I started connecting with this guy. I'm thinking I'd drink with this guy. Most of the people in AA wouldn't drink with him. I'd drink with this guy. And then he starts talking about coming to the next morning and how he'd be like a scared little kid. And I'm sitting there going, oh, my God, I used to do that every morning. I'd come to in terror, shaken. And how does he know this? And I'm starting to really connect with this guy. Because I'm listening to him because of the way he looked. And then he says, he ended up in prison getting this life sentence, and he ended up going to the AA group there. And in Alcoholics Anonymous, he found God. And the minute he started talking about God, it was like a steel door closed in my head. I remember sitting there, and when he's talking about finding God, I remember sitting there thinking to myself, oh, what have they done to him? Oh, you poor son of a bitch. Oh, my God. Oh, not him. Not this guy. Oh, I just lost respect for him. He'd become a sunbeam for Jesus. Oh, no. Oh, no. I remember thinking, oh, God, I'd rather die than be that way. And I almost did. And I almost did. Believing in God doesn't make sense. You know, if Alcoholics Anonymous, if there was to be a debating society, and they had this big debate, and the winner of the debate won $1 million in cash, and one side of the debate was to debate that Alcoholics Anonymous works and had to debate it logically, and the other side was to debate it doesn't work, I think for $1 million, I think I'd rather be on the side that proves that it doesn't work. Because it's a more logical argument. I mean, we're hopeless people beyond human aid. Psychiatry can't help us. Medications don't really do much for us. Church hasn't had much help. Family has wrung their hands trying to help us. We have tried with everything in us. In a room with carpenters and plumbers and retail clerks and a couple ex-prostitutes is going to help a guy like that when all the professionals can't? Doesn't make any sense. That God's going to help the guy? Yeah. Doesn't make sense. Except that we're here. My friend Charlie years ago told a story about a bumblebee. He said, if you've ever seen a bumblebee, they don't look like they can fly. If you read a book on aerodynamics, you'd probably come to the conclusion that a bumblebee with this little tiny fat stubby body, tiny little wings, probably can't fly. It's aerodynamically unfit for flight. The problem is that the bumblebee hasn't read a book on aerodynamics. Maybe if bumblebees could read books on aerodynamics, they'd be falling from the sky. Who knows? I don't know. And the reality is we're here. A few years ago, I had this guy ask me to sponsor him. He's a smart guy, which isn't good. When it comes to alcoholism, everything's backwards. Out in the real world, you're smart. It's an asset. When it comes here, no, it's not an asset. No, it's not. We bury our smart guys. And he's a smart guy. College educated, brilliant, bright guy. Probably has an IQ of 150. Bright guy. And he corners me after a meeting one time. And he says to me, he says, are you open-minded? And I said, well, I think so. I try to be. He said, well, then I want you to entertain a proposition. He says, could you entertain the possibility that there really isn't a God? That you have just psyched yourself into thinking there is one, and consequently you've done all this stuff you're crediting to God, but it's really you and your positive thinking. It's not really God. Could you believe that it's an illusion? That you've recreated your own life? It hasn't been God? And I had never anybody present anything like that to me before. Kind of took me back. I thought, phew. And I tried to get as honest with him as I could. And I said, you know something? Objectively, you could be right. Maybe at the end of the trail, I'll die and I'll find out that it was all an illusion. There wasn't really God. But I'll tell you something. I'm going to go see that real nice car out there in that parking lot. I'm going to go get my car. And I'm going to let you get in the passenger side, and I'm going to give you a ride back to the Salvation Army. And then I'm going to go up to my house on the hill that I own, and I'm going to go and watch my TV and go to bed and be grateful for the illusion. And I'd rather have the illusion than go back into that abandoned building and trying to get up enough courage to kill myself. I'd rather have the illusion. And I don't care what it is. It's good. It's good. It's the best life I've ever had. Next month, I go over to England. I go over there every June for some AA stuff. A couple years ago, I was over there with Chuck, one of the guys I was working with, and we were at a conference, and we were down walking around Hyde Park, and I know Ralph's been over there several times, and near Buckingham Palace and all that stuff down there. And there's an odd thing down there. The street lights in that part of London are not electric. They're gas. And if you look on the side of the poles, there's a little thing, looks like a little box kind of about this big. And what it actually is, it used to be a door that was a little door that you could open and stick a key in and turn the key and it would turn the gas on. But now technology's in place. They have computerized electric starters and lighters on the gas lamps, and those doors are welded shut and painted over, but this, you can still see where they were on the side of the posts. And years ago, before the technology was in place, they had a guy whose job it was to go up and down the streets of London with a key, and he'd turn the gas on, and he'd reach up with a long pole, and he'd light the street light. And at twilight, you could climb up to the top of the highest building in that part of London and look over the city and try to look down and see where this guy was lighting the lamps. You couldn't see where he was, but you could see where he'd been. And I could sit at two and a half, three years sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I couldn't see where God was, but my God, could I see where he'd been. I could see where he'd been in my life, and I could see where he'd been especially and more distinctly in the lives of the people I tried to sponsor and help, the guys that came out of the detox after I did and through the Samaritan House after I did. One of the great marvels of Alcoholics Anonymous, for those of us that stay in the trenches, and I don't mean going to the home group where all your buddies are, that's fine. But those of us that go into the detoxes and the county jails and we go to the places where you find the desperate cases, we get to see something that is amazing. We get to see up close and personal the men and women who are beyond human aid. And we get to see something happen to them. We get to see men and women who have had their children taken away from them by the courts and are told at one point they would never see their kids again. We get to see them get their kids back. We get to see crazy stuff, like the guy that was living in the bushes behind the Alano Club, he bought his first home. That's impossible. We see that stuff all the time. The guy who had been in and out of psych hospitals and medicated and told he'd be on medication the rest of his life, and he's free, and he's sponsoring five or six guys, and the lights are on. He takes nothing, and he's laughing, and he's having the best time of his life. How did that happen? The best psychiatrist on the planet couldn't do that for him. How'd that happen? And I guess we get to see the hand of God in others. And it's easier to see it in others, I think, than it is to see it in ourselves. First of all, to watch God work in your own life is a very hard thing to watch, because he's slow, but he's very old. And to try to watch the hand of God in your life is like trying to stand in front of a mirror and watch your hair grow. It doesn't mean it's not growing. It's just like hard to watch. But I could see it more distinctly in you, because I don't see you for a week or two, and then I see it 2 weeks later, and it's like a snapshot of the change in 2 weeks. Then I see another 2 weeks, and it's another snapshot. And then you put them all together, and it's like a fast, speeded up movie of from the gutter to life. It's an amazing thing to watch. Amazing. Page 55. I want to touch on a couple things that Ralph started to talk about. This I think the middle two paragraphs on 55, it is really a vision of exactly what I'm going to find is a result of steps 4 through 9. I'm going to find something that I don't even believe exists necessarily. And it's okay if I don't believe that exists. If I just take the actions as if it might exist, let's see what happens. Let's see if the hologram pops for you. Let's see if something happens as a result of It says, actually, we are fooling ourselves, for deep down in every man, woman, and child is the fundamental idea of God. Well, I remember it being new, listening to, we used to have a guy come to Vegas once or twice a year that would talk, a guy, Chuck Chamberlain. I used to listen to Chuck talk about the God within you, the God's in here. I remember watching him after a meeting. Some guy came up to him and said, where can I find God? Chuck poked him in the chest. He says, not lost. He's in there. I used to hear old timers talk about getting quiet, being alone with themselves, quiet, and listening to the still small voice of God within them. And I'd think, well, that sounds pretty cool. I'd go home to try that. And, oh, my God, I don't run into God. I run into Legion. I mean, it's like, I get quiet. When it gets quiet out here, it gets noisy in here, man. It's, I mean, I don't, are you kidding? That's why we suggest for new people, don't, until you work the first 9 steps, don't meditate. And if you're going to, don't have any sharp objects around. You know, don't do this without a net. Because we're blocked. The reason is, the book says we're obscured. It's in there. There's a portal to the hard drive of the universe somewhere in my heart. But I can't access it. Because when I go inside me, it's blocked. It's blocked by what? 3 things it's obscured. Calamity. What is it about me that I like calamity. I like excitement. If I'd have come in here this morning, put a bottle of milk over there, put a bottle of vodka over here, everybody in this room had seen that vodka. I'm telling you. It'd been like it had been cut, surrounded in neon. You'd all seen the vodka. Some of you wouldn't have even noticed the milk, but you'd noticed the vodka. I had a friend, Jimmy Williams. Jimmy, I love Jimmy. He was such a good guy. He died several years ago. If you ever want to hear a funny speaker, he's hilarious. Jimmy used to say, quizzically, he says, I don't know what it is about me. You put 50 pretty girls up there, I'll get the sick one every time. What is it? I'm attracted to calamity. If I go to an amusement park to this day, and there's one of those roller coasters that makes you want to scream and cry like a little kid, and a merry-go-round, I may not even see the merry-go-round, but I'm from the parking lot, I saw that roller coaster. I like that. That excitement. I like the edge. Now, I don't like going over the edge. I just like the view from the edge. Later in our book, it says that we're producers of confusion rather than harmony. Harmony, peace? Nah. I want calamity and confusion. I like juggling. I like getting 10 balls in the air. You know, my favorite, there was an act in Vegas. I'm not big on jugglers, actually, but there was an act where a guy would juggle running live chainsaws. Now, that's a juggling act. See, that's calamity in motion right in front of you, right? You know, if you want to hear what the voice of calamity, what would calamity sound like? Imagine that a surgeon could surgically implant a microphone into your brain on a bad day. And through loudspeakers, we'd get to hear everything you think. We would hear the voice of calamity. We'd hear Legion. So if God is inside you, even if he had a megaphone, how are you going to hear him over the chatter and the noise and calamity in your head? How are you going to hear him? The second thing that blocks me from God is pomp. I think that's a good word for ego. I get so full of myself and my ideas and my judgments and my opinions that there's no room for anything else. When it says later on in the book that selfishness, self-centeredness is the root of our problem, our troubles, they're not kidding. I am so consumed in myself that I am separate from you and I'm separate from God. I fit the old adage. You can always tell an alcoholic, you just can't tell him much. I'm not against the idea of God. I resent it because I think he has my job.
There is one who has all power. That one is Bob. May you find him now. And then the third thing that blocks me from God, from this power within me, was the hardest one for me to see. Worship of other things. If you would have put me on a lie detector when I got sober and said, now that you're sober, Bob, do you worship anything? I would have said, absolutely not. And it would have said I was telling the truth. But I don't even know what that means. And then I'm a year and a half sober. I'm ending my first sober relationship. I got to tell you something. I don't think there's a person on the planet more self-obsessed than an alcoholic ending a relationship. You can go up to a person like that and say, well, I just came from the doctor. I have terminal cancer, 2 weeks to live. And you know, and they'll go, you know what else they said? You know, the... Well, that's what I got the breakup of this relationship is like right here on me. And I'm in pain and desolation. So I go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous thinking I'm going to hear something that's going to snap me out of it, make me feel better. Well, the problem is I can't hear anything in the meeting because the big show's on the inside. I'm stuck in my head thinking about if I see her, I'll say this, and then she'll say that, and then I'll say this, and she'll say that, and then I'll say this. She'll realize how wrong she was. Beg my forgiveness. So, no matter, God's trying to talk to me through the people in the meeting, right? And nothing's getting in. And here's the hideous part. She's a member of AA, and she's not in that particular meeting, which means that some hideous force has implanted a spring in the back of my neck connected to the meeting room door. Every time the door opens, I go, not her, okay, not her. So by the end of the meeting, I'm not any better. I'm actually worse because the subject's gratitude or something. And there's some kind of cosmic joke. Do you ever notice this? When you're entering a relationship, all of a sudden, you're in a world of happy couples. What the hell's that about? Right? Is that some kind of cosmic joke? So by the end of the meeting, I'm not doing any better. I'm actually a little worse. And there's an old-timer there, a visitor from Glendale, California, who was sober a long time. I think it was 28 years. And he wanted to ride back to his hotel, and we ended up going out to coffee, and I kind of have him hostage. So I'm sitting in this coffee shop, and I start telling him about this relationship for 20 or 30 minutes till his eyes have glazed over. And he was very polite, listened to me, nodded, listened to me. And when I was done, he said some things that just blew my mind. He said to me, he said, kid, have you ever thought about the first commandment? When he said that, I bristled a little bit. I told him, I'm not really into that. I'm just into AA. And he starts laughing. He says, yeah, I know. He says, you and I are a lot alike. Guys like us have a hard time getting past the thou shalt not. He said, but in my experience, the Ten Commandments were originally written as statements of spiritual cause and effect. And as they were translated through different languages, the Aramaic and the Greek and the Latin, etc., by the time they got to the English, they had some well-meaning people had put an authoritarian spin on them. He said, they're simply statements of spiritual cause and effect. The first commandment is, I am the Lord thy God, thou shalt not put false gods before me. And he said, I know something that no matter what I do, God will always love me. There's nothing I can put between me and God that will get God to stop loving me. The problem is when I put something between me and God, I put something between me and God. I block the light. He said, when you worship something, it doesn't mean to bow down to, it means to obsessively turn your consciousness towards. He said, you want to know what you worship? At the end of the day, make a pie graph of everything you were thinking about in that day. And the thing that dominates the pie would obviously be the thing you're obsessively turning your consciousness towards. When he said that, I could picture this pie graph with a little sliver for AA, a little sliver for work, and the rest of it was the relationship. And I knew why it felt like somebody had crimped the oxygen hose to my very being.
why I felt depressed and like as if my very spirit was smothering here and dying. I felt horrible. Because, not because of the loss of the relationship, because I took the relationship and I put it in the place in my life where God should have been. It had been my source of validation, emotional security, sustenance, and well-being. I tied my future up in it. I wasn't in love with that person. I was in love with a fantasy and an idea of how it could be if she ever came to her senses under my tutelage. What's it say later in the book? And the show would be great. And I knew I did that. I knew in a desperate, frantic, futile search for the power to validate myself and make myself whole, I had unknowingly and unconsciously positioned myself towards that relationship as if it was my source. I didn't even know I did that. Now, that was close to 30 years ago. I wish I could tell you that I haven't done that since. But I can't tell you that. Over the years, sometimes it's been a resentment. Sometimes it's been a fear that I just won't let go of. I can't stop worrying about stuff. Do you ever get something you can't stop worrying about? Right? Sometimes it's either sex or money. You get something like you can't stop. You know you should. You know worrying's not helping. But it's this illusion that I can wrest happiness and satisfaction out of this world if I manage well, as if I'm going to think the divine thought that's going to make it shape up, right? Or something, right? I've had my business became dominated the pie at one time. My daughter at one time, when problems she was having when she was littler. Different, a marriage since then, two marriages since then, two divorces since then. I'm consistent. A lot of things. And it's because I am driven by a vacancy to seek something that is not easily found. And so I settle for things that look like they may be an alternative. Time and time again. And I think we all do that to some degree. If we didn't do that, we wouldn't need step 10 and 11. We would just take the third step and be good to go. But I have certain default positions in my life that, left unchecked, I always go back to. Not because I'm a dumb guy, not because I'm a bad guy. It's just the nature of what it is to have this malady of my spirit called alcoholism, is that there's this propensity and continual inclination to play God, to try to fix everything so I'll be better. That's why in step 11 it says something very interesting. It says we must constantly remind ourselves we're no longer running the show. You know why? Because we're constantly trying to. A little further on down the page, it says, we finally saw that faith in some kind of God was a part of our makeup, just as much as the feeling we have for a friend. Sometimes we had to search fearlessly, but he was there. He was as much a fact as we were. We found the great reality deep down within us. I love that term for God, the great reality. In chapter 5, they read a line, it's every meeting almost reads it, most of us don't hear it. It tells you in chapter 5 exactly where you'll find God, exactly. It says, there is one who has all power, that one is God. May you find him in a place most of us seldom visit, now. See, I can tell by looking at some of your eyes, you're not even here. You're in your head going, oh, what page is that on? Oh, I can't wait to tell that at the meeting, in the noon meeting at the club. You're not even here when I'm saying that. Now, right here. If you want to be in the presence,
you have to be in the present. And I'm not easily in the present. I'm a thinker. Self-centered, self-involved people live up here. And we're disconnected from life itself. So consequently, we're disconnected from God. God does not live in my head. God is everything. He lives in life itself. He lives right here. He's right here with you. Some of you that do 12-step work, I know you've had this experience. Not through prayer and meditation, but you're working with a new guy. And all of a sudden, you feel something flowing through you, and you feel more connected to God than you ever felt through prayer and meditation. Why is that? Because in the action of the primary purpose of helping another alcoholic, the same thing happened to me that happened to me when I was 18 years old and I drank 3 shots of whiskey. It relieved me of the bondage of self. I came out of here, I became right present with you, and I was free. You ever had this experience of listening to a 5th step and the guy's getting into the real heavy stuff? And you're so present, you can hear him breathing as he's talking. You're so present. Alcohol did that for me at one time. If you can remember the times when you're early drinking, when you'd walk into a bar or a party, so locked up in you, you can't even hear the music. It's just everything's distant and vacant. Leave me alone. And then 5 drinks, you can hear the music. 7 drinks, and you're very interested in the people around you. You're listening. You're hearing them. About 9 drinks, you love them. I love you, man. Relieved of the bondage of self. The great reality deep down within us, and it says in the last analysis, it is only is a big word. Only is like, only. It is only there that he may be found. It was so with us. Isn't it odd that we always look in the last place, the last analysis? I avoided coming to Alcoholics Anonymous. I kept being made to come here, but I would prefer psychiatry and all that, other doctors and stuff. I want people with degrees. I don't think a plumber can help a guy of my depth and complexity. And yet, when I ran out of options and there was nowhere else to go and I tried everything else, I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. And then in Alcoholics Anonymous, my first 4 years, I sought power everywhere else except through this process. Partly through ignorance, partly through opportunity, partly through a part of me that was still a victim of a delusion that I could wrest happiness and satisfaction out of this world by managing well. I sought power in jobs. My first 4 years of sobriety, I went through 9 jobs in 4 years. That speaks volumes of my spiritual condition. Everywhere I ever worked, looked like a good job going in. I wouldn't be there very long until they were idiots, I'm telling you, every place. It's either I have a lot of bad luck with jobs or I'm the biggest idiot magnet on the planet. And I was always the guy that was leaving. Problem with relationships. Everything it talks about on page 52. Still restless, irritable. Depressions periodically that I couldn't escape. And in one of the jobs I had in those first 4 years, a guy gave me a set of tapes. I was 4 years sober before I worked the steps out of the book. I mean, really worked them the way they were outlined. I did several inventories. I did all the other stuff people around AA at the time were doing, the 12 by 12 and the life stories. But in that first 4 years, I suffered immensely from alcoholism. But I stayed sober through a lot of 12-step work, 15 meetings a week, and a lot of service positions. There was a guy that I worked for who was trying to redeem me as an employee, and he saw something in me he thought was valuable, I guess, and he gave me a set of tapes, not recovery stuff, it was like motivational speaker tapes, by a guy named Earl Nightingale, not an AA speaker, just a motivational guy. A set of tapes called Lead the Field. And I'm listening to these tapes, and Earl told a story in there that affected me very much. And he said it was a true story, and it was about this guy in the 1800s, in South Africa, who had inherited a farm from his father. And it was a nice farm, a very, very
successful ranch. And the problem he inherited the farm, the ranch, at a time when there were people striking it rich, finding diamonds in South Africa. The diamond boom was starting. And he'd hear these stories of these guys becoming Bill Gates kind of rich overnight. And the more he heard of their abundance and wealth, the more dissatisfied he became with what he had. Now, some of you will relate to that. And finally, couldn't take it anymore. He sold the ranch, took the money from the sale, invested in equipment, went out into the bush, obsessed with finding diamonds. Well, there's several accounts of his story, but the one that Earl told was that he never did strike it rich. He died out in the bush, bitter, broke, and alone. And it came to pass that he sold the ranch to these two brothers that were developers. And one day, Earl says, they're moving these rocks aside to clear this land. And they found these very unusual stones, weird-looking stuff. Didn't know what it was. Discovered they were uncut diamonds in the rough. And in no time, they discovered that this ranch was the largest diamond deposit ever recorded in South Africa. And these two brothers, in a very short period of time, became two of the richest men on the planet. They had to hire dozens and dozens of diamond cutters from Belgium to come down and work in their company. And they hired thousands of workers and natives to work in the mines and brought guys in from all over the place. They developed a marketing company to distribute and cut and polish and market these diamonds worldwide. And one day, as they're putting this all together, the one brother says to the other, "We need to name our company something." And the brother says, "Hey, yeah. Hey, let's name it after that poor SOB we bought the ranch from. Wasn't his name De Beers?" And I'm listening to Earl tell this story, and I'm thinking, I'm that knucklehead. I'm looking everywhere else for power, everywhere else for a solution, and yet I go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous every day, twice a day, and they read something at every meeting, and I don't hear it. These are the steps we took, which are suggested as a program of recovery. I need a Harley Davidson. These are the steps we took, which are suggested as a program of recovery. Oh, I bet with her I'd be spiritual. These are the steps we took, which are suggested as a program of recovery. I need a better job. These are the steps we took, which are suggested as a program of recovery. I need more sponsees, more commitments. These are the steps we took. And at 4 years sober, I crashed and burned. I was in danger of leaving Alcoholics Anonymous, possibly of drinking. I could not outrun my alcoholism no more. There wasn't enough meetings and enough activities. And I finally started going back into the steps, and my life started to change. You want to take a break?
Yeah.
9 minutes. 57 seconds.